You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, that are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collection of, actually, lecture cycles, volume Collected Works 181 by Rudolf Steiner. Main title is Dying Earth and Living Cosmos. This is a reading of the third of these sub-cycles that are in this collected work. The title is The Need for New Forms of Consciousness. These are translated by Matthew Barton. This is lecture 16 in the collected works. It is, however, lecture 2 in this smaller cycle. This lecture 16 is given in Berlin on the 3rd of July, 1918. Next week, I will continue the observations we began a week ago and draw some conclusions from them. But today, I wish to speak of something apparently not connected, but in fact very much so, which relates to our building in Dornach. The very distinctive quality of this building is intended to play a part in humanity's evolution, the spiritual development we have perceived as beginning in our time and which we must assume will continue to unfold. We have attempted to shed light from the most varied angles on the characteristic nature of these present and future developments, so far only present in germinal form. Today, let us consider how the aims of anthroposophically oriented spiritual science are expressed through the building in Dornach that will be dedicated to it. One way to consider contemporary developments is to study them externally, as people are accustomed to do, whose whole focus and outlook are adapted to outward reflection. But in our time, there is also good reason to observe the inner aspect of all that happens. In fact, we can only gain a true picture of what happens in the world by bringing spiritual insight to bear on it, on how it has long been prepared and will in future assume quite different forms from contemporary occurrences. I would like to start today with something very material in nature, which can, however, be spiritually observed to reveal impulses always active around us. Though few people have formed a comprehensive view of contemporary occurrences, those who have include some engineers. Several decades ago, in 1884, the mechanical engineer Reuleau wrote an essay about characteristic aspects of modern culture, albeit from his materialistic perspective. At the time, he divided modern humanity into two groups, one whose way of life and outlook he called natural, and the other manganistic. He derived the latter word from magic, as an attempt to employ the powers of the universe to intervene in human life. Today, very briefly, I first want to consider this division of humanity into two. In former times, in a sense, all people were natural, and the great majority are so still today. The minority, composed primarily of Central and Western Europeans and the people of America, are manganistic people. The important thing to note here is that natural culture still plays an important part in modern life. It is significant that so-called manganistic culture has only really developed gradually during the past century. The most paradoxical outcome of this latter-day culture is that it has artificially introduced into the world much more human presence than the actual number of human beings on Earth. Over the past few decades, this smaller portion of humanity has brought the machine, mechanical inventions, to untold development. You will not be surprised to hear that a great proportion of the work accomplished nowadays is done by machine. Yet you may be somewhat astonished to hear the scope, which can be calculated, of human work now done by machines in place of human beings. This can be calculated, as I say, in terms of the millions of tons of coal that are consumed annually to power these machines. One discovers that the work accomplished in this way through coal-powered means comes to no less than that of 540 million human beings who would need to work 12 hours every day to do what these machines do. In truth, therefore, we cannot say that there are just 1.5 billion people alive on the earth. Besides these, there are another 540 million more, existing by virtue of the mechanistic, rather than natural, work accomplished by machines, overseen by a minority of the earth's population. The population of the earth is not truly expressed by population statistics, for they should include a further 540 million people. One can say that in Europe and America, less so in Eastern Europe, we are surrounded by work that continually impacts on our daily life of far greater dimensions than we realize. This work simply replaces natural human endeavors. The people of the West are extremely proud of this accomplishment. They highlight the fact that what machines perform produces a great deal more than is produced in the rest of the world by far greater numbers of people who do not yet employ machines to such a degree and live in a natural way, in quotes. Thus we say that if the work done by machines were undertaken by people instead, 540 million people would have to work 12 hours a day. That is a lot. And as you know, our modern global culture is very proud of this achievement, which has various consequences. To gain insight into what underlies this, you need only consider one instance where natural culture intrudes a very great deal into our modern mechanistic one. The match is an example of this. The younger ones among us will not remember this, but the older members will recall times when matches were still rare, and a flame was kindled with steel, stone, and tinder. This leads us back further still to an older way of kindling fire, to the bow drill, which required a great deal of human effort to get a flame going by turning a wooden drill in a piece of wood. If you compare this ancient natural way of kindling a flame, in quotes, with the modern match, something else becomes apparent. To a large degree, the whole of our mechanistic culture renders invisible the laws which people were once close to. It suppresses these active laws. Consider the ancient way of making fire. The work a person had to undertake to do this was intimately connected with himself and his personal accomplishments. Nowadays, physical, mechanical, or chemical processes replace this and distance us more from natural phenomena and our involvement in them, in which a spiritual occurrence is also at work. Natural phenomena are removed from immediate human activity. You will frequently hear people saying that new technologies have subjugated and mastered natural forces to serve us. From a certain point of view, this is fully justified, but it is very one-sided and incomplete. In everything which mechanical agency accomplishes, a term in which I also include the transformation of matter into chemical energy and its use, natural forces not only serve humanity, but are pushed further away from us, along with their deeper connections to what really are world impulses. In the machine, the human being is gradually withdrawn from a clear view of natural process itself. Technology, therefore, does not only serve humanity, but pushes something away from us. Through technology, something dead comes to overlay living nature. The living quality that once played directly from nature into human labor is pushed away from us. And if you consider that really we extract what is dead from nature to introduce it into mechanistic culture, it will no longer be so surprising to you if I relate the science of the spirit to what a mechanical engineer has to say. The engineer Relu accentuates the fact that humanity's recent progress is dependent, and here he is right, from his particular perspective, on enlisting natural forces to serve human culture. Above all, however, we must first turn our attention to the fact that we are dealing here with mechanisms, with machines, that replace human effort. This is not just something confined to what we see with our senses, but this process, this creation of an extra workforce of 540 million, in quotes, people on Earth, has a very significant spiritual dimension. Human energy has crystallized in everything that has arisen in this way. Human reason flows into it, in a sense, and works within it. But this reason, surrounding us in machines, has now become detached from human beings. The moment we detach from humankind, something that is intrinsically connected with it, the powers we have described as Aramanic in our science of the spirit take direct possession of it all. These 540 million contrived beings on Earth are at the same time containers for Aramanic powers, for the powers of Ahriman. This is something we should be aware of. And it means that the purely outward progress of our civilization is bound up with Ahrimanic powers. And these are the same as exist in the nature of Mephistopheles, which closely resembles Ahrimanic qualities. But nothing one-sided ever exists alone in the universe without its opposite number. Never just one pole without the other pole emerging. These Ahrimanic qualities, arising on the earth in the material forms of industry and so on, the machine age, have their counterpart in a corresponding complement of Luciferic qualities engendered in the spiritual realm. Ahrimanic nature never emerges in isolation, but to the same degree that it emerges visibly on earth as I have described, it is balanced by Luciferic qualities that are interwoven with this whole Ahrimanically imbued culture. The will of human beings on earth, as Ahrimanic culture crystallizes, is at the same time infused with a spiritual correlate. And this works into human intention, human impulses, passions, and moods. A Luciferic spirit being actually exists to correspond with every Ahrimanic machine. As we create our machines, we slip down into a dead realm, which is, therefore, all the more outwardly visible and apparent as Ahrimanic culture. But as a mirror image of this whole Ahrimanic culture, an invisible Luciferic culture arises. In other words, humanity's morality, ethics, and social impulses are pervaded by Luciferic moods to an extent corresponding to the increasing scope and number of machines. The one cannot arise without the other. This is how the world is composed. We can see from this that it is never a matter of fleeing Ahriman, nor equally of fleeing Lucifer. All we can do is observe the emergence of this state of affairs in which polar, Ahrimanic and Luciferic qualities balance each other and are inevitably connected with the further developments of human culture in our time. Spiritually perceived, this is what happens. And starting in our time, we must increasingly try to perceive things spiritually. Now, it is very striking that when Relu, the mechanical engineer, lauded humanity's manganistic progress, which was wholly justified from his perspective, and spiritual science should never be reactionary, he also emphasized something else. He pointed out that humankind in this developing new world of machines, especially in Europe and America, will need to cultivate stronger powers of spiritual life and culture than formerly, when culture was still more embedded in nature, and when human labor related more intimately to the natural world. Naturally, he did not speak of Lucifer or Ahriman, but simply describe things as I presented them at the beginning of today's lecture. I'm sure you will be able to discern what I have added to the observations of an engineer who lives fully in the modern materialistic world. For instance, Relu said naively that if art is to continue to thrive, it will require stronger engagement with aesthetic impulses than was necessary in former times of more instinctive culture. But he was basing this statement on a rather curious belief, a naive belief apparent from his statement that in art the human soul lives more intensely in aesthetic laws compared to the anti-aesthetic machine, something he readily admitted. He saw the machine as invidious to art. But his naivete here is his complete lack of awareness that this will require the development of more intense and active artistic powers imbuing the human soul than used to be the case. He could see that technology is attacking everything that humanity once drew from spiritual sources, but not the inadequacy of compensating for this merely by returning to these old sources. This really is not possible. Stronger, more spiritual powers must enter our spiritual life as human culture advances on the physical plane. For otherwise, humanity would inevitably succumb entirely to materialism, however much it theoretically resists this. You may perhaps see from this that starting from awareness of the impulses at work in our modern culture, we can come to insight into the inner nature of current developments. Art needs a new impulse, a new impetus. If our anthroposophically oriented spiritual science is to offer new impetus to the old spiritual culture of humanity, then inevitably art too must receive a new impulse of this kind. A first and naturally very imperfect beginning has been attempted here with the building at Dornach. I fully acknowledge the imperfections of what is only a first attempt, but it may be justified for us to see it as heralding further developments of this kind, further progress on this path. Those who will follow after us, who will continue working when we have long departed from our physical bodies, will hopefully do it better. The impulse for the Dornach building did have to emerge now, though. You see, we can only properly understand this building if instead of applying absolute standards to it, we concern ourselves a little with its history. I would like to start from this, since we continually encounter misunderstandings in this respect. As you know, from 1909 onward, our work was associated with the performance of various mystery plays, aiming to give an artistic and dramatic portrayal of the powers at work in the world as we see them. These performances in Munich were accompanied by lecture cycles that were always well attended, and our Munich friends therefore conceived the idea of creating a building dedicated to these activities and spiritual endeavors. This was instigated not by me, but by the members in Munich, and I beg you to remember this. The building was really a response to the feeling among a good number of our members that more space was needed. Given this need, it was quite self-evident for this new building to have an architectural form in harmony with our worldview. In Munich, this was conceived only in terms of internal design and architecture, since the building was to be surrounded by a number of houses accommodating members who wished to settle there. These dwellings would have adjoined and surrounded the new building, which, since it would not have been visible amongst the other dwellings, was intended to be as inconspicuous as possible. Only the internal architecture of the new building was, therefore, considered, and internal design only has significance in this case if it affords a context and framing appropriate for the activities that go on there. But this must be conceived artistically. It must not just reflect, but really give artistic expression to the activities that happen in it. This is why I always compare the architectural concept of our building, perhaps a little trivially and yet also aptly, with the idea of a cake mold or cake tin, which gives the cake inside it the right form. The cake tin, in this case, is all that surrounds and encompasses our spiritual scientific activities, our artistic endeavors, and all that is spoken, heard, and felt there. All the latter is the cake, and the rest is the tin. And this needed to find expression in the internal design of the building. But after various endeavors to conceive and realize these plans, on the site we had already acquired in Munich for the purpose, we ran into opposition, not from the police or the local council, but from the artistic community in Munich. We realized that people were affronted by what we wished to establish there, although they did not say what they themselves would have done instead. Whatever further modifications we might have introduced, the whole thing could have gone on fruitlessly for decades. Finally, we decided to abandon the idea of a building in Munich and to use a site in Solothurn instead, which one of our members had offered us for the purpose. The building was therefore to be built on the hill at Dornach near Basel in Solothurn Canton. Here there were no surrounding houses, and the building would be visible from all sides. And people were very keen for the building to be built quickly. Without completely altering the idea I had already formulated for the internal design, all I was able to do was to try to connect the building's exterior with the internal design, as already conceived. This meant that the building as a whole had certain deficiencies, which I, more than anyone, am aware of. But that is not the chief thing. What is important is that a beginning has been made, as I said. But now, I would like to consider a few things briefly that aim to show the distinctive nature of this building, so that you may see how it is connected with our whole spiritual scientific or spiritual stream. The first thing you will notice, if you look at it without prejudice, is that the building's outer cladding, its walls, are conceived as quite different from ordinary buildings. The artistic idea underlying the outer wall of all buildings hitherto is to shut them off from their surroundings. Other walls are always conceived as defining the limits of the building, and all architectural and sculptural work on these walls is associated with this overriding idea of the wall as delimitation. While we have naturally retained an aspect of this in a physical sense in our building in Dornach, in artistic terms, we have broken with this customary view. Here, the exterior wall does not confine and delimit the space of the building, but instead opens its space to the whole universe, the macrocosm. If you are inside this building, therefore, you should have the sense that the space in it is broadened into and connected with the macrocosm through the walls and their shape. Everything in it aims to represent such connections with the universe. This is the underlying principle in the shape of the walls, in the pillars, too, which accompany the walls at certain intervals. It is the principle, too, in all the carving and sculptural elements, the pillars with their pediments, architraves, capitals, and so forth. In other words, the walls are conceived as transparent to the soul, as opposed to ordinary walls that shut off and delimit space for the soul. Here we should feel ourselves to be free in the infinity of the universe. Naturally, physical space does still have to be delimited, but the forms of these boundaries can be artistically worked to overcome the sense of this physical confinement. Everything else in the building is connected with this principle. The symmetries we find in other buildings had to be dissolved correspondingly. The Dornach building only has a single axis of symmetry, really, oriented precisely on an east-west axis, and everything else is arranged around this axis of symmetry. The pillars at intervals Along the walls, therefore, do not bear identical capitals, but stand in pairs, on left and right, of identical capitals and other form elements, each pair differing from the next. Thus, if you go into the building through the main entrance, you first come to two identical pillars, whose capitals, pediments, and architraves are the same. And thus you pass identical pairs as you continue through the whole building. This enables us to introduce evolution into the motifs of the capitals and pediments. The capital motif of each pillar always evolves from that of the previous one, exactly as an organically more perfect form evolves from one less developed. Here the identity of symmetry is resolved into ongoing development. The whole building consists of two main parts. The rest of it are subsidiary or adjoining spaces, which have a basically circular plan and finish above as domes. However, these two cupolas intersect in a segment, and so their base is not composed of complete, but of incomplete circles. A forward part of the smaller circle over the smaller space is missing, and this is where the other circle, that of the large hall below, connects with it. The whole is such that we have two cylinders here, one of larger and the other of smaller diameter. In the larger is the auditorium, while the other smaller cylinder is where the mystery plays and other presentations are performed. At the place where the two circles merge will stand the speaker's rostrum. There, too, the curtain is situated. In this way, the two cupolas are joined, something that has not been done before in this way. Technically, too, it was an interesting challenge to make two cupolas intersect and join with each other. The whole wooden edifice rests on a concrete base and platform, which really only comprises the cloak rooms. Concrete steps lead up from there into the wooden building itself, which rests on the concrete foundation. Along the length of the wall of the larger cylinder, beneath the larger cupola, runs seven pillars on each side, and in the smaller space, six pillars on either side. Thus, in this smaller space, which forms a kind of stage area, stands a circle of 12 pillars, and of 14 pillars in the larger auditorium. The sculptural motifs of these pillars develop as we pass around the circle. The motif developments surprised me myself, even as I worked on them. When I made the model for them, conceiving the pillars and their capitals, one thing greatly surprised me. There is absolutely nothing symbolic about them. People who have described the building to others, saying that there are all kinds of symbols adorning it, and that the anthroposophists work with symbols, are wrong. There isn't a single symbol in the whole building, in the sense they mean it. Rather, the whole building is shaped in accordance with its overall form, is conceived in a purely artistic way. In other words, it does not signify, to use this word in its worst sense, something that is not actually there. Instead, this ongoing evolution of the capital motifs and of the architrave motifs is drawn purely from the way one form emerges and arises from another. As I developed each form out of the last in this way, it gave rise, in a quite natural way, to a picture of evolution truly perceived rather than Darwinian notions of it. I did not plan this in advance, but it arose quite naturally and led me to see, I myself was surprised by this, how certain human organs, for instance, are simpler than in a lower order of animals. I have often said that evolution does not make things more and more complex. The human eye, EYE, for instance, is more perfect by virtue of being simpler than in animals, evolving toward greater simplicity. As I created these motifs, it became apparent to me that from the fourth motif onward, a process of simplification was necessary. What is more perfect turns out to be simpler. But this wasn't the only thing that surprised me. When I compared the first pillar with the seventh, the second with the sixth, and the third with the fifth, I discovered remarkable congruencies. In working sculpturally, of course, one has areas of relief and concavity, which I created out of immediate feeling and perception. But in looking at the capital and pediment of the seventh pillar, I found that the relief areas of the seventh pillar corresponded to the declivities of the first and vice versa. They accorded precisely with each other. I'm speaking in terms of convex and concave, of course. An inner symmetry arose quite naturally, and it was quite different from an outward one. In the metamorphosis of the motifs and their sculptural realization, the architecture became more mobile, and the sculpture came to rest. All is simultaneously wooden carving and architecture. The whole building rests on a concrete understructure whose interior has motifs which are likely to surprise those who enter it. Naturally, people come with preconceived ideas and judge what they see according to what they know. Many who were not sure what to make of it all have said that the Dornach building is, in quotes, futuristic. The forms of the concrete part of the building are conceived in response to the new material, concrete, and its artistic potential. But within the concrete shell, we have also tried to create pillar-type supports. Quite of themselves, these assumed the appearance of elemental beings, who grow gnome-like and riven with fissures out of the earth, and at the same time have a load-bearing design. And so one sees that they give support, but they bear a heavier part, which they push back, shift back, in a different way from a lighter part. That is the wooden substructure. The need also arose for windows, something that wouldn't have figured in Munich, where we were concerned only with interior design. If you wish to understand the windows, I would ask you to try to picture the whole idea of the wooden structure first. As it stands there, it is not really art, or at least not an artwork in itself. The pillars, walls, and sculptural motifs are artistic, but the whole thing does not aim to have a decorative character. There was no decorative intent. Instead, it will invoke in anyone looking at it certain feelings and thoughts in every line and surface. One has to follow the lines and surfaces of the building with one's eyes, with feeling vision. What we experience inwardly, as we let our gaze run over these contours, really only gives rise to an artwork in relation to the wooden sculpture that comes into being in human sensibility. The concrete substructure and the wooden part of the building prepare this work of art in us. The work of art is something each person must create for himself, build up in himself, through his delight in these forms. In other words, this is the most spiritual part of the building. The work of art that emerges only does so, really, when the receptive soul of the listener or the speaker is inside the building. And so it was necessary to insert windows, always one window corresponding to the space between two pillars. To elaborate here, too, on the underlying principle of the building, we had to find an appropriate glass engraving technique. We took colored panes of glass and engraved corresponding motifs into them, and thus we have glass windows with etched motifs. Using a larger version of the instrument that a dentist uses when he drills into a tooth, we etched into the thick glass panes to remove what we needed to, creating different thicknesses of glass. The motifs arose from these differences of thickness. Each pane is of a single color, and the sequence of windows with different colors gives rise to a harmony. In its axis of symmetry, the building, as one passes through it from the entrance, displays a sequence of colored windows in harmonious color evolution. But here again, the work of art as such is not yet complete. It only becomes so when the sun shines through, And so we have created here in this system of glass windows something that requires living nature outside to interact with the glass engravings to create the work of art. The motifs engraved on the colored windows show many aspects of the content of our spiritual science, always perceived imaginatively. The dreaming human being, the intrinsic nature of the wakeful human being, diverse secrets of creation, and so forth. These are not portrayed in symbols, but in direct perception, all with an artistic intent, but only complete when the sun shines through them. Here again, therefore, we have tried to do the same thing by other means, to overcome the confinement and enclosure of the space. With the architectural and sculptural treatment of the building, we've tried to use forms in a way that overcomes space, inwardly, of course, not physically, and lead the gaze out beyond it. This is already more sensory and tangible in the case of the windows, whose connection with the sunlight shining through from the cosmos, shining also through our visible world, is something intrinsic to them. These two aspects of the building, therefore, primarily correspond to an element of soul created from without, on the one hand, by the interaction of light and glass engraving, to produce the work of art as such, as soul element, and on the other, the spiritual element arising through the wooden sculpture, experienced as work of art in the human soul itself. The third aspect of the building is embodied in the paintings on the inside of the cupola, whose motifs are once again drawn from our spiritual scientific worldview. Here, expression is given to the content of our worldview in painting, at least as this extends over a certain large macrocosmic time frame. Here, you have the physical aspect of the matter, if I can put it like that. You see, in painting, for certain inner reasons that are beyond the scope of today's lecture, what one wishes to portray can only be portrayed directly. The color itself must express what it is intended to, likewise the forms and lines of a painting. We have therefore tried, through the content depicted there, to go out into the macrocosm, to overcome the boundaries of the cupola walls. The content itself carries us outward, and these paintings depict everything, really, that belongs to the macrocosm, and thus our eyes see what is intended in a directly physical way. We have tried to accentuate the luminosity needed for painting these motifs by using pure plant-derived colors. Naturally, all this has not been as successful as it might have been if the war had not intervened. It is, anyway, only a beginning. The mode of painting employed here, naturally, has to accord with our view of things. In painting the spiritual content of the world, we are not concerned with figures and forms conceived as illumined by a light source, but illumined from within and of themselves. Thus painting here must acquire a quite different character. If we paint a human aura, for instance, we have to paint in a different way from that used to depict a physical form. A physical form is painted by distributing light and shadow across it as they would be when illuminated by a light source, whereas the aura is self-illumined, and so the nature of such painting becomes quite different. In very broad outline, therefore, to the extent we can describe such things without pictures, these are our aims for the building. As I said, the whole building is oriented from west to east, with the axis of symmetry passing through the pillars in the same direction, intersecting with the small cylinder, thus the stage area at its eastern edge. And here, as one faces east, between the sixth pillar on the right and the sixth pillar on the left, stands a sculptural group, carved in wood. This is an artistic representation of what I will call the most intimate aspect of our spiritual scientific worldview, seeking to depict something that must necessarily come to inform human spirit vision in our time and in the future. Humanity must learn to see that everything of importance for the world's development and human life flows into the three streams portrayed here. In a sense, the normative spiritual stream with which we are interwoven, then the luciferic stream and the Ahrimanic. Divine evolution, luciferic evolution, and Ahrimanic evolution are interwoven with everything. Both the foundations of physical life and the manifestations of spiritual reality. Again, though this should not be conveyed symbolically, but should become living artistic expression in this sculptural group, a sculpture in wood. This idea came to me, and I believed I grasped it as idea, and yet I am not yet myself clear about the reason for this in its esoteric depths. I trust that future esoteric research will make this plain. It certainly strikes me as quite right, though, that while all ancient motifs are best represented in stone or bronze, all Christian motifs, and this is a Christian motif in the truest sense, are better executed in wood. All I can say is that I have always found it necessary to reimagine the group in the Church of St. Peter in Rome, Michelangelo's Pieta, in wood. And only then, I believe, would it represent what it should. And the same is true of the other Christian sculptures in stone. I have not yet discovered why this should be so, but at all events our group had to be conceived and executed in wood. The chief figure in this group is a kind of representative of humanity, a figure who should represent the human being in his divine manifestation. I will be happy if anyone who looks at this figure has the feeling that it is a representation of Christ Jesus. But even trying to create the figure of Christ Jesus would have seemed to me an inartistic endeavor. I wished to represent what actually stands there. The viewer of the piece is then free to experience whether this is Christ Jesus. I would be very pleased if this is his experience, but it was not my preconceived intention to portray this. A truly artistic thought is embodied in purely artistic form, in the figure and shape, while anything else is a novelistic or programmatic idea, a preconception of how Christ Jesus should be represented. Art, at least sculptural art, lives in form. So in this group, which stands 8.5 meters high, the chief figure is somewhat elevated, with cliffs behind it and cliffs below. Underneath, from a cavern in the rocks, an Ahrimanic figure emerges. The figure is half reclining in its rocky cavern, its head directed upward. Above, upon these somewhat undercut rocks, stands the chief figure of the group. Above the figure of Ahriman, and to the left of the viewer, a second Ahriman grows forth from the rocks, so that the figure of Ahriman is reproduced a second time. On the viewer's left, likewise, and also above the Ahriman figure, is a Lucifer figure. A kind of artistic connection has been created between Lucifer and Ahriman below him, just a little higher, above the chief figure of the group, and to the viewer's right is another Lucifer figure. Lucifer is therefore also represented twice. And this other Lucifer has collapsed inwardly, and now falls headlong because of this. The right hand of the central figure points downward, the left upward. The upward pointing left hand points to the place of rupture in Lucifer, to the exact place where he has broken in two and tumbles downward. The right hand and the right arm of the central figure point down to the lower figure of Ahriman, and make him despair. The whole is conceived, I hope people will get this sense of it, without any aggression from the central figure. There is only love in the gesture I described. Yet neither Lucifer nor Ahriman can bear this love. Christ does not battle with Ahriman, but simply radiates love. But neither Lucifer nor Ahriman can allow love into their proximity. Through its proximity, one of them, Ahriman, experiences despair, a sense of being inwardly consumed, while Lucifer falls headlong in consequence. The gestures of Lucifer and Ahriman convey this inner state. These figures, of course, were not easy to create, since I had to create spiritual beings. Lucifer and Ahriman are entirely spiritual beings, and the central figure is so partly. It is the hardest thing of all to convey spiritual reality in sculpture. Yet I tried to achieve what was needed, especially for our purposes, to resolve the form, although it necessarily remained artistic form, entirely into expression and demeanor. As human beings, we have only a very limited capacity to use gesture and facial expression. Lucifer and Ahriman, on the other hand, are entirely gesture and demeanor. Spirit forms do not have clearly defined outlines and confines and are never fixed. If you wish to give artistic expression to the spirit, this is like trying to portray lightning. A spirit has one form one moment and another the next, and we have to take account of this. Trying to fix a spirit form as it is at one moment, in the same way that one depicts a resting human form, would give rise only to a rigid figure far removed from reality. Instead, one has to invest everything in the gesture, as I have tried to do here with Lucifer and Ahriman, and partly also for the central figure, who naturally is a physical figure, that of Christ Jesus. Now I would like to show you a few photographs to give some sense, as far as this is possible, of this central group. The first shows the head of Ahriman, in the form this first came to me. A person, think here of the threefold human being consisting of head, trunk, and extremities, who is entirely head, and who is therefore an instrument for the most extreme cleverness, wariness, and cunning. The figure of Ahriman seeks to convey this. As you can see here, the head of Ahriman is fully spirit, if I can use this paradoxical expression. But you are aware that spiritual descriptions often have a paradoxical character. The figure is true to the spirit, artistically true to nature. Ahriman had to, in quotes, sit still so that this could be achieved. The next one shows Lucifer seen to the left of the group from the viewer's perspective. To understand Lucifer, one has to think in a curious way to conceive his spiritual form. One has to, in quotes, think away what is most Ahrimanic in the human figure, thus get rid of the head, but at the same time greatly enlarging in your mind the ears and auricles, the outer ear, though naturally spiritualized, and forming wings, and formed into an organ, albeit one wound around the body, together with the larynx, which is likewise greatly enlarged. And thus the figure's head, wings, and ears, together form one organ. The wings in this head organ arise when one seeks to portray Lucifer. Lucifer is a widened and broadened larynx, a larynx that becomes the whole figure, and from which, through a sort of wing, a connection is made with the ear. You see, Lucifer is an entity who hears the music of the spheres, assimilating this into his wing-ear organism, and without any interference or utterance from individuality, the cosmos, the music of the spheres, speaks through this organ, which, transformed in the front into larynx, is thus another metamorphosis of the human form, a larynx, ear, wing, organ. His head is therefore only rudimentary. If you go and see this group in Dornach, you will find that the figure of Ahriman embodies what can be conceived as form and figure, whereas the head of Lucifer, although it is difficult to picture this being so, is something beautiful to the greatest degree. Thus Ahriman is everything reasoned, clever but ugly in the world, while Lucifer embodies beauty in the world. Youth and childhood are more luciferic, and advanced age more Ahrimanic. The past is more Ahrimanic, and the future more luciferic in their impulses. Women are more luciferic, and men more Ahrimanic. But everything consists of both these streams. The being above Lucifer arose as an elemental being growing out of the rocks. The group was more or less finished, and we had taken away the scaffold when, curiously, it became apparent, as Miss Waller expressed it, that the whole gave the sense of too much weight on the right, in aesthetic terms only, of course, and needed a counterbalance. Rather than merely adding another lump of cliff, it was necessary to pursue the sculptural idea further. And so this being here emerged, growing out of the rocks like an elemental entity, an addition that karma asked of us, you might say. You will notice one thing in particular with this being, albeit only as intimation, that symmetry must prevail the moment we consider spirit forms. That asymmetry must prevail the moment we consider spirit forms. In the physical realm, this comes to only very limited expression. Our left eye is slightly different from our right, and so on. The same is true of ears and nose. The moment we enter the spiritual domain, the ether body acts in a very asymmetrical way. The left side of the ether body is quite different from the right, and this comes to the fore the moment one tries to create spirit forms. You can walk around this being, and it will show you different aspects from every different angle. But you will see that asymmetry is necessary here as expression of the gesture, a certain humor, with which this being looks over the cliff and gazes down upon the group below. There are good reasons why it looks down humorously like this over the edge of the cliff. It is wrong to try to rise into higher worlds equipped only with mere sentimentality. Sentimentality is misplaced in such efforts, since it always has a tinge of egotism. You will often notice that in speaking of the highest and most spiritual matters, I introduce a certain tone to try to dampen egotistic sentimentality. People will only be able to raise themselves to the spirit by avoiding egotistic sentimentality, entering spirit realms instead with a purity of soul that can never be entirely devoid of humor. Now here is the head of the central figure in profile, as it necessarily arose. Here again the head needed to have a somewhat asymmetric quality, showing that the inner soul of this figure is expressed not only, say, in the movements of the right and left hands, of the right arm, and so on, but that this inner life in a being such as Christ Jesus, who lives entirely in the soul, also impresses itself upon the form of the forehead and the whole of the figure. This is much more so here than can be true of human gestures otherwise. Although this doesn't correspond to reality, we experimented with reversing the slide in the projector, thus giving a quite different appearance, simply by means of this reversal. This gives a different impression. The artistic conception of asymmetry, though, is something you will see only in the finished head of the central figure. It is true to say that all artistic questions really do play into the elaboration of such a form. The smallest artistic question of detail invariably relates to a much broader whole. Here, for instance, we were particularly concerned with the surface treatment, which is key to a sense of life and vitality. First, curving the plane and then curving the curve again, this special treatment of the surface, with its double curvature, draws life itself from the plane, and this is something we only notice as we work through these things. And so you will see that what we sought to achieve does not lie only in the content or represented idea, but also in a certain artistic handling of the subject. Rather than a novelistic or representational depiction, we tried to convey Ahrimanic and Luciferic nature, and human nature too, by a kind of fingertip sensitivity to material, working right down into the surfaces in a fully artistic way. The broadening of our perception into the spiritual realm is matched in the other direction by a deepening of artistic expression. This group is to stand in the stage area on the east side of the building, and above it arches the smaller cupola, the latter also painted as I described. Above this group we have tried to recreate the same motif again in painting, Here is the Christ with Lucifer above and Ahriman. And we have tried to use colors to artistically express all this. You can see from the different modes of treatment that such things must be drawn entirely from artistic means. All this was only possible thanks to a number of our friends who worked on the building with the greatest dedication. The most curious comments have been made about the building, but eventually, perhaps, people will come to see what dedication and commitment was shown by members of our society, artists in particular, in devoting themselves so selflessly to its creation. In relation to this sculptural group, in particular, important artistic questions arose. Miss Marion, for instance, worked most wonderfully at transforming a world view into artistic expression. Naturally, the building is not yet complete, though no doubt it would have been if it had not been for the catastrophic global events which hindered our work. In these brief aphoristic outlines, I wanted only to show you what we intended to accomplish with this building. I hope that this has given you at least a small glimpse of what we can now hope will eventually come to completion in Dornach. Our concern here is to place our worldview visibly and artistically into the culture of today and the future. Then people will see that this worldview is more than mere theory, is rather a totality of real and living powers. If we had created something merely symbolic, people would be right to say that this is just theoretical. But since our worldview shows itself capable of engendering real art, it is something more. It is alive. It will engender other life, too, and be vitally productive in other domains. Today there is a great longing for a life of spirit suitable for our age. But there is also a great deal of unproductive illusion in this domain. I do hope people will learn to discern what emerges from the real needs of humanity's present condition, and what arises only from confusion and hallucination. Everywhere one sees, as it were, the mushrooming aberrations of what ought to arise in the life of spirit in our cultural life. We have to learn to distinguish between half-crazed distortions and what genuinely seeks to emerge from humanity's authentic powers of spiritual development. Today you can hear much that is very misguided. It is quite natural that people hearken to such things, for this shows they are seeking the Spirit. You need only open your eyes to see that people seek the Spirit everywhere. A metaphysical novel by the writer Korff has just been published, terrible rubbish, and really just inept propaganda for the Star of the East. I do hope people will learn to tell the difference between such distortions and the real endeavors we need today that go to the very root of human existence and human striving. The end of Lecture 16.